Hello, and welcome to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Sunday, January 30th, 2022. I'm your reader, Sharon Falduto, wondering what that construction equipment noise is outside my house. It's not a snowblower, because it didn't snow. The first story today from the front page above the fold of the Gazette, Eastern Iowa pipeline incidents are rare despite fears. Three companies asking to build CO2 pipelines in Iowa by Aaron Jordan of the Gazette. Pipeline explosions can injure, sicken, or even kill people, and leaks can pollute the environment. But most of the time, pipelines transport gas and hazardous liquids quickly, efficiently, and with so few mishaps, people forget the steel tubes are there. That's largely the case in Iowa, where there have been only a handful of major pipeline incidents, and some of those go back decades, according to federal safety records and local emergency responders. I've been here since 07 in my position, and they have been the least of my problems, said Dave Wilson, Emergency Management Agency Coordinator for Johnson County. We spend a lot more time with transportation or facility hazmat than pipelines. According to the Iowa Utilities Board, which governs pipelines in the state, Iowa has 46,663 miles of underground pipelines, with 42,211 miles used for shipping liquefied natural gas and 4,448 miles moving hazardous liquids such as oil, gasoline, or propane. Three corporate groups, Summit Carbon Solutions, Navigator CO2 Ventures, and ADM Wolf Carbon Solutions, plan to apply for permits from the board this year to build pipelines to ship liquid carbon dioxide from ethanol and fertilizer plants to sites in North Dakota and Illinois, where the CO2 would be sequestered underground instead of being released into the atmosphere. At informational meetings for the projects, some Iowans have expressed fear about pipeline explosions, particularly on routes that run close to homes and schools. A CO2 pipeline explosion in February 2020 in western Mississippi, for instance, caused the evacuation of 300 people and sent 45 to the hospital. The Gazette looked at the gas and hazardous liquids pipelines that already are underground in Linn and Johnson counties and checked their safety records. Linn County has about 100 miles of underground pipeline, according to online maps published by the Pipeline and Hazardous Materials Safety Administration, part of the U.S. Department of Transportation. Nearly all of those are for distributing natural gas. Some lines run through populated areas, such as the residential neighborhoods near the College Community School District campus, maps show. But those pipelines have not caused major safety concerns, said Tom Ulrich, Operations and Readiness Officer for the Linn County Emergency Management Agency. We're pretty fortunate here in Linn County, he said. If you told me it was an ammonia line, I'd be a lot more concerned. I'm not saying this is safe 100%. I'm just not having a panic attack. It's running through Cedar Rapids. Mid-American Energy of Des Moines has about 37 miles of gas pipeline in Linn County and 60 miles in Johnson County as part of the utility's more than 10,000 miles of distribution and transmission pipeline in Iowa. The company has had only two incidents since 2014 and only one in Iowa, the Pipeline Administration reported. In both incidents, excavators accidentally damaged pipelines after not calling ahead to have lines marked. In a Polk County incident in 2015, the contractor who drilled into the pipeline suffered burns on his arms and face, records show. The federal government has not pursued enforcement actions against MidAmerican since at least 2006. Alliant Energy, based in Madison, Wisconsin, owns about 30 miles of natural gas pipeline in Linn and Johnson counties. Since 2014, the company has had one incident. In 2019, a contractor in West Burlington struck a gas line near a house and caused a fire, records show. No one was injured. Linn County has about 18 miles of hazardous liquid pipelines that run through the southeast corner of the county, but neither pipeline passes through a city or major residential area. One of those pipeline owners, Buckeye Partners, has had 120 incidents since 2014, but none have been in Iowa, records show. There have been no enforcement actions against the Houston-based company. Magellan Midstream Partners, based in Tulsa, Oklahoma, has 2.5 miles of hazardous liquid pipeline in Linn County and about 50 miles in Johnson County. Magellan also owns a terminal and above-ground storage in Coralville at the southwest corner of Interstate 80 and First Avenue. How many people drive by Magellan's terminal in Coralville in an hour and they don't think anything about it, Wilson asked, until it's a problem. Most people don't pay attention to it. Magellan has had 132 incidents since 2014, including 11 in Iowa. Two of those incidents, one in 2020 and one in 2021, were at the Coralville terminal, where Magellan staff noticed small leaks and made repairs. The energy industry, regulators, and pipeline safety advocates have worked to inform people who live near pipelines and excavator contractors about the potential risk of a leak or line strike, said Bill Karam, executive director of the Pipeline Safety Trust based in Bellingham, Washington. There are a lot of incidents caused by excavation damage, third-party services, Karam said. That's what led to the 811 campaign. 811 is the national call before you dig phone number. The people are supposed to call to have underground utilities marked before excavation, but this doesn't always happen. More than one quarter of the Iowa pipeline incidents since 2014 were caused by contractors hitting a pipeline, records show. MidAmerican Energy hosts and attends meetings designed for excavators to discuss pipeline markings, safe excavation practices, and what the law says about calling before you dig, spokesman Jeff Greenwood said in an email. Energy companies monitor pressure in their pipelines, and if there's a change, possibly indicating a leak or explosion, they can halt or reroute the flow. Many companies also use an inline inspection tool called a smart pig that can be sent through the line to check for weakness or cracks, Karam said. While there's still a lot of technical progress to be fully confident in results, they have gotten a lot better at finding anomalies and points of corrosion, Karam said. You can get a lot of information about a pipeline without digging it up. However, if the pipeline companies were doing inspections as often as they should, there wouldn't be any incidents, he said. We would love to see more inspections. We all share the goal of zero incidents, and we're not there. Also from the front page, enrollment drops, rates rise at Iowa community colleges, by Vanessa Miller of the Gazette. As Iowa community college enrollment drops, tuition ticks up, perpetuating a cycle that's influenced by a range of factors like the pandemic, the economy, and the need to balance a budget. The cycle mirrors community college trends nationally and threatens their ability to help meet new workforce demands. Still, a new 2021 Iowa Condition of Community Colleges report, released this month, highlights efforts the two-year public campuses are making toward the governor's Future Ready Iowa goal of getting 70% of working Iowans education or training beyond high school by 2025. Iowa's 15 community colleges educate the largest demographic, 40.1%, of all Iowa residents enrolled in public or private 2 and 4 year post-secondary institutions in the state, exceeding the national average of 35.6%, according to the Iowa report, citing the National Center for Education Statistics. But like Iowa's public universities, community colleges recorded enrollment losses in the last COVID-19-plagued academic year, spanning fall 2020 to summer 2021. There were 116,979 students enrolled in credit programs in AY 2021, an unprecedented decline of 7.9% from the previous academic year, according to the report, conceding the average annual community college enrollment already was declining nearly 3% since 2012. Credit hours also decreased to 1,553,727, representing a 7.2% decline since last year. Joint enrollment, the tally of high school students also taking community college courses, dropped nearly 9% in the last academic year, from 51,800 in 2019-20 to 47,262 last year. Those students enrolled in a total of 395,603 semester credit hours. This significant decrease in jointly enrolled students and credit hours is consistent with an overall decline in student and credit enrollment, presumably attributed to the COVID-19 pandemic, according to the report. Non-credit enrollment, students pursuing personal or academic skill building, workforce preparation, industry-specific technical courses, and continuing education for recertification and licensure, dropped 3%, and the adult education and literacy headcount of 10,676 students was nearly 23% down from the previous year. The one student group that predictably swelled across Iowa's community colleges in 2020-2021 academic year was online enrollment, as institutions nationally made an unparalleled degree of instruction virtual due to pandemic concerns. More than 77,000 students enrolled in online four-credit learning at an Iowa community college in 2020-2021, up nearly 11% from the year prior. Just as they adapted from a narrow focus in 1918 to the comprehensive educational system and workforce training vehicle they are today, Iowa's community colleges are prepared to adapt to the economic and technical challenges presented by COVID-19 and a changing economy, the authors of the report note. Though the pandemic made an immediate impact on higher education, community colleges are built to be highly responsive to student needs, even as challenges emerge. A Although access to education remains a hotly debated issue regionally and nationally, with Iowa's public four-year universities increasing tuition, every community college in Iowa raised rates for the current academic year. On average, the price per credit hour for an in-state student rose $5, or about 3%. Hawkeye Community College posted the biggest rate hike of $10, amounting to a 5% jump, while Iowa Lakes Community College posted the lowest of $2. Cedar Rapids Kirkwood Community College upped its tuition $6 per in-state credit hour from $180 to $186. Kirkwood's out-of-state per credit hour rose from $237 to $249. Iowa code prohibits community colleges from charging in-state students more than do Iowa's public universities. The annual report indicates the highest per credit hour rate at an Iowa community college is $202, up from the highest of $176 in 2017-18, but still 38% below the lowest base rate at a public university of $325. The highest community college rate is, however, rising faster than the public universities at 13% compared with 12%. And while financial aid remains a critical component of college accessibility and affordability, collective community college and distributions dropped last year. Aid distributions. Where more than $309 million was distributed in the 18-19 year, that total decreased to $265.4 million in 2020-2021. Kirkwood and Des Moines Area Community College, the largest in the state, had the most federal Pell Grant recipients in the recent year, with Kirkwood counting 3,950 students awarded disbursements of $13.6 million. State-funded aid, however, has increased, including through the Future Ready Iowa Last Dollar Scholarship, given to students pursuing a credential for a high-demand job. In the 2020-21 academic year, $19.3 million was awarded to 7,604 students. In a statement, 18-year-old Stephanie Jenkins, enrolled in the medical assistant program at Northeast Iowa Community College, said the Last Dollar Scholarship was a big help as she didn't qualify for any other student aid. "Last Dollar Scholarship was great for me," she said. "I didn't have to worry about getting a part-time job while in school to pay for tuition. I could just focus on learning." And turning to the Iowa Today and the Week in Iowa, a recap of news from across the state. In the news, NFL quarterbacks film show at Hy-Vee. An unusually large crowd gathered Tuesday at the Cedar Falls Hy-Vee. Retired NFL star quarterbacks Kurt Warner and Peyton Manning were filming scenes inside the grocery store for an upcoming episode of Manning's documentary series, Peyton's Places. Warner is a local legend because of his connection to the University of Northern Iowa and his underdog backstory. The college backup went from stocking shelves at Hy-Vee to eventual stardom in the NFL. Court ruling. A federal appeals court this past week allowed the state of Iowa to enforce a law that prevents schools from imposing mask mandates, except for those attended by students whose disabilities make them more vulnerable to severe illness if they get COVID-19. The court found that a mask requirement is a reasonable accommodation for students with such disabilities and allowed a group of parents of disabled children to pursue a lawsuit that seeks to strike down the law. January 6 charges. A Northwest Iowa man was arrested and faces four federal charges in the January 6, 2021 attack on the U.S. Capitol after a relative tipped off the FBI. Court records say an FBI agent arrested Kenneth Rader on January 20th in Sioux City. He is charged with knowingly entered a restricted building, two counts of disorderly and disruptive conduct and demonstrating in a Capitol building. FBI agent Michael Banfield said in an affidavit that the agency received a tip January 8th from a relative. The tipster referred to Rader as my radicalized family member and indicated Rader had shared videos of himself on the Capitol grounds and inside the building and has verbally threatened former Vice President Mike Pence. Under the heading, they said, "When it comes to these gun-grabbing, freedom-hating, over-regulating, civil liberty-violating tyrants, here's my message." And he held up both middle fingers. Thank you. That was Iowa Representative Bobby Kaufman, Republican Wilton. Most folks with vehicles that exceed that amount, $4,650, should either use that excess value to support themselves or should not be on the program. Foundation for Government Accountability lobbyist Scott Centurino to Iowa House Subcommittee voting to advance a bill that would require Iowans to undergo an asset test to receive SNAP benefits. Under the heading Odds and Ends, Convention of States, Rick Santorum, winner of the 2012 Iowa Republican Presidential Precinct Caucus, spoke in the Iowa Capitol Rotunda at a rally Tuesday supporting an Article 5 Convention of States. Santorum leads Convention of States Action, which proposes using a process in the Constitution by which two-thirds of all state legislatures approve a convention where states could propose amendments to the U.S. Constitution. Multiple Republican state legislators also spoke at the rally. And traffic camera. Two bills dealing with traffic enforcement cameras are advancing in the Senate. SF 2061 would prohibit the use of any traffic camera that is maintained, installed, or serviced by an out-of-state company. SF 2062 would require any local government agency that institutes a traffic enforcement camera to provide safety data that shows why the camera is needed. Under the heading The Water Cooler, Swan Rescue, a Davenport couple rescued a mute swan stuck in the ice in the Mississippi River. After watching the swan become less and less active over several days, the two dug it out of the ice and turned it over to conservation officers who planned to deliver it to Wild Thunder, a wildlife rehab and sanctuary in Independence. Umpires needed. The Northern Iowa Officials Association has sent out a letter to area school districts warning that summer baseball and softball seasons may be canceled unless more people sign up to officiate games. And under the heading More in the News, Iowa Doctor Goes National. An Iowa-licensed physician says she is staging jailbreaks that involve pulling patients out of hospitals against the medical advice of other doctors. Dr. Molly James operates a clinic in Sheraton, and much of what James says about COVID-19 contradicts the federal government's advice on mitigation and treatment. She recently appeared on a call-in talk show aired by Lindell TV, a video channel created by Mike Lindell, the MyPillow founder, who has been active in spreading discredited claims of voting fraud in the 2020 election. And assisted living death. A woman who lived at an assisted living home for people with dementia died after being found outside last week on a bitterly cold day, Polk County authorities said. The woman was found outside the Courtyard Estates at Hawthorne Crossing in Bondurant early Friday when the low temperature was -9 degrees. Polk County Sheriff's Lieutenant Ryan Evans said the woman was alive when the deputies arrived, but died later at the hospital. And turning to the Insight page, the Gazette's editorial, Infrastructure Impact, federal funding package signed by Biden last year will have far-reaching effects in Iowa. This editorial is accompanied by a lovely photograph of a bridge, the Centennial Bridge over the Mississippi River in Davenport at sunset, and with this caption, the 81-year-old bridge creaks under the weight of tens of thousands of cars and trucks every day, and rust shows through its chipped silver paint, exposing steel that needs replacing. This city's aging landmark is among the thousands of structurally deficient bridges in the state. The federal infrastructure bill, approved by Congress last year, was hailed as a historic investment, and it is. It provides hundreds of billions of dollars for badly needed projects throughout the United States. But when the nation also has a historic backlog of work that needs done, an injection of new money will only go so far. Expectations have been very high, so we need to temper that because the needs far outpace the funding, Iowa Department of Transportation Director Scott Marler recently told an Iowa House committee, according to the Gazette's James Q. Lynch. Only about $550 billion of the $1.2 trillion package is new money, while the rest is funding Congress had already planned to spend. Between the new and old money, projects in Iowa are expected to get some $5 billion over the next several years. As bureaucrats divvy up the dollars, the infrastructure bill's impacts in Iowa are coming into view. Several of them are things the Gazette editorial board has been advocating for years. Bridges. Iowa leads the nation in having the most bridges in poor condition, with 4,500, according to the Federal Highway Administration. That's not necessarily because Iowa is particularly delinquent on upkeep, it's just that Iowa has a lot of bridges in our vast network of county highways and farm-to-market roads. To put it in a national context, analysts expect the infrastructure bill to help repair about 15,000 highway bridges. If Iowa's needs were to be fully funded, it would claim nearly a third of that total. Under a federal formula announced this month, Iowa will receive $432 million in bridge funding over a five-year period, or a little more than $80 million per year. Given the many variables in bridge updates, compounded by workforce and supply chain shortages, it's uncertain how many projects will benefit from the federal spending spree. But combined with state and local contributions, it should make a significant dent in Iowa's deficient bridge problem. Water. The state's aging water treatment, transmission, and distribution systems present potential public health hazards. The Environmental Protection Agency totaled $8 billion in needed Iowa water infrastructure projects in a report last year. Under the federal funding plan, Iowa is set to receive $638 million for water infrastructure over the next 5 years, including a $111 million haul for the first year. One of the primary goals of the program is to reduce dangerous chemicals in the water supply. In a letter to Governor Kim Reynolds last year, EPA Administrator Michael Regan urged the state to focus its share of the money on underserved communities. The issue is especially pressing in rural towns, where shrinking tax bases are increasingly unable to make the significant investments needed to upgrade their infrastructure. Broadband. A top concern from Iowa policymakers for at least a decade has been broadband internet. Iowa is among the worst in the nation for broadband access, internet speed, and availability of affordable service. Predictably, the lack of access is particularly acute in rural areas. Iowa will benefit from at least $100 million in infrastructure bill funding for broadband, which Biden administration staffers say will provide high-speed internet to 74,000 Iowans who currently don't have it. About a quarter of Iowans are expected to qualify for a new federal assistance program to help cover the cost of internet service. It's important to recognize that internet infrastructure is just as important as hard infrastructure like roads and bridges. For Iowa to prosper in the 21st century, we need to be connected. And locks and dams. Inland waterways, like the busy Mississippi River on Iowa's eastern border, are vital to the manufacturing and agricultural sectors, facilitating hundreds of billions of dollars in economic activity annually. Yet the infrastructure that helps move the boats has fallen into obsolescence. Barges often face delays due to inadequate lock and dam capacity, which drives up the cost of products. The Army Corps of Engineers plans to spend more than $829 million on lock and dam upgrades on the Upper Mississippi River, which stretches from northern Minnesota to St. Louis. It's reported to be the biggest influx of funds for such projects since the 1930s, when the system was developed. After years of leaders in both parties identifying this growing problem, it's good to see our important water highways getting some resources. These funding priorities illustrate some important features of Iowa's infrastructure landscape. It is a sparse state where a declining but still substantial portion of the population live in far-flung small towns. It takes a lot of miles of infrastructure, roads, pipes, fiber cable, to meet everyone's needs. The mounting list of needs serves as a reminder that Iowans need to commit to proper upgrades and maintenance on an ongoing basis. Infrastructure bill funding is a much-needed boost, but more investments will be needed. Adam Sullivan's column in Iowa. Local governments in Iowa spurning their critics. When the COVID-19 pandemic pushed local government proceedings online, many cities and counties made it possible for the first time for the public to participate remotely. And when George Floyd's murder set off a historic protest movement, there was suddenly a lot more interest in the institutions that oversee our police departments and sheriff's offices. Some of those protesters didn't go away when the mass demonstrations wound down. Now local politicians are finding they don't like the extra scrutiny. The Des Moines City Council last week voted 6-1 to amend its rules and require all motions to get a second before being considered by the council. That is the council's prerogative, but the timing of the vote made clear it was an effort to stifle one particular council member's participation in meetings. Indira Shoemaker, an organizer of the Des Moines Black Liberation Movement, recently joined the council after defeating an incumbent in last November's election. At the council's previous meeting, Shoemaker tried to make a motion in favor of city support for a winter shelter. Amid crosstalk from the council and audience members, Mayor Frank County instead entertained a motion to adjourn and abruptly ended the meeting. The Des Moines Register editorial board, which endorsed one of Shoemaker's opponents in last year's election, said the new rules make the council more like a kindergarten and less like a deliberative body of elected adults. I suppose it was meant to send a message. Shoemaker might have a seat at the table, but that's all it is, a chair, a nameplate, and a microphone, the latter of which is strictly not to be used out of turn. Des Moines has earned a reputation for lashing out at critics, but others in Iowa worry that the capital city is becoming a model for cities and counties to follow. Johnson County activists are repeatedly running up against what they see as barriers to access. The situation boiled over at a Johnson County joint entities meeting this past week, where representatives from various government entities get together to share reports about interjurisdictional issues. Dozens of members of the Excluded Workers Fund Coalition, which is advocating for direct payments to residents who were not eligible for federal stimulus checks, showed up, but most of them were denied entrance to the meeting room and no one from the group was allowed to speak. Johnson County Board of Supervisors Chair Roysanne Porter briefly recessed the meeting and sheriff's deputies removed advocates from the area, the Daily Iowan reported. When confrontations arise, the people in power shroud themselves in fancy talk about process and decorum. These niceties are designed to allow politicians to avoid making uncomfortable decisions. Our representatives give mayors and unelected managers broad authority to dictate the agenda, and they're reluctant to broach a subject before manufacturing some level of consensus behind the scenes. The real deliberations often don't happen in public view, but instead in private conversations between individual council members and the usual suspects of local stakeholders, government staff, real estate developers, nonprofit leaders. When those same insiders want to address a council or board in open session, they're usually given indefinite time. Officials will even talk back and forth with them, which they refuse to do with the public out of some contrived concern about public meeting rules, even when the concerned citizens are responding to items on the agenda. They could allow more back and forth with the public and still comply with the law, but they choose not to. It's a bad idea to disrupt meetings, but cities and counties are inviting as much when they choose to limit debate and dissent in their proceedings. The Republican-controlled state government rightly has gotten a lot of criticism for efforts to unduly embolden police and limit free speech rights, but local governments run mostly by Democrats seem to be doing a bang-up job of it on their own. And Todd Dorman's column, 24-Hour Dorman, who does Kim Reynolds serve? Check the checks. At least on these frigid days, we can get a warm feeling knowing our governor has friends in sunny Boca Raton. Weather forecasts don't include wind chill down there. According to campaign finance filings this month, in 2021, Governor Kim Reynolds raised more than $100,000 in donations from Boca Raton, that luxury paradise along the Atlantic coast north of Miami. Steve and Barbara Scott of Boca Raton gave Reynolds' campaign $50,000. Steve Scott is a retired chairman of a medical investment company. He and his wife recently donated $20 million to Duke University to expand its sports medicine program. Why are they interested in who governs Iowa? You got me. Richard Stark of Boca Raton donated $35,000 to Reynolds. Stark is an Iowa transplant from Fort Dodge who founded Iowa Commodities Limited and was chairman of the First American Bank. The John E. Stark Revocable Trust of Boca Raton also donated $25,000 to Reynolds. Not warm enough yet? Consider travel. Our governor did some flying around in 2021. Reynolds received more than $34,000 in in-kind donations from donors to cover the cost of flights. Where the governor went is difficult to tell. But one flight on April 29th, at a cost of $6,515, was on the same day as Reynolds appeared on Laura Ingraham's Fox News show along with other red state governors. You might recall, she used the appearance to say she's turned down $95 million for school COVID testing and declared her support for banning transgender schools from participating in sports. Red state trailblazers don't fly commercial. The flight was provided by Kurt Crowell, president of Crowell, a large concrete and paving company operating in several states based in Lawler. It was one of three flights Crowell donated. Crowell also donated $25,000 in cold hard cash to Reynolds' campaign. These are, of course, mere drops in the ocean of campaign bucks Reynolds raised in 2021 as she prepared to run for re-election this year. She raised $3.7 million and ended the year with nearly $4.8 million in the bank. Reynolds received 244 $1,000 donations, 128 $5,000 donations, 57 $10,000 donations, and 30 $25,000 donations. Her donor list is largely a recounting of the usual suspects who have given hefty bucks to her in the past. There's Ankeny commercial real estate and development executive Denny Yelwell, who donated $50,000. Another $25,000 was kicked in by Bruce Rastetter, whose Summit Ag is seeking to build a 700-mile carbon pipeline from Iowa biofuel plants to North Dakota. Frank Brownell III, chairman of the board at firearms maker Brownells, donated $25,000. The big numbers are generally reported within the scope of the political horse race, which in the case of Iowa's gubernatorial election doesn't look like much of a nail-biter. The leading Democratic contender, Deidre Jagir, burned through much of the $280,000 she raised last year and entered 2022 with just $8,500 in the bank. That stunning cash gap is exceedingly bad news for Democrats who had better get behind their candidate or watch a governor they deeply dislike waltz to another term. But it's also instructive to look at Reynolds' numbers as a reminder of who her administration and the Republican-controlled State House truly serves. Want to know which constituencies the governor actually cares about? Check the list of checks. The large agricultural interests, business interests, developers, and others are all lined up in black and white, bearing green. They have the governor's ear, so it should be no surprise when Reynolds decides big tax cuts that will greatly benefit these donors are far better than providing adequate state funding for public education, universities, our mental health system, public health, and other needs. We could make a real effort to clean up Iowa's water, but the check raters really aren't going to like that. During the heights of the pandemic, when health experts were calling for mitigation measures, Reynolds was instead checking in with the check writers. Most Iowans, according to the polls, are okay with this. As for the rest of us, including public school teachers, frontline healthcare workers, Iowans struggling to get through privatized Medicaid, parents who don't want books banned from libraries, LGBTQ youth, the message is clear. You got no checks. But maybe if we all pitched in, we could at least buy the governor a flight to Boca Raton. And turning to the Insight page and today's cartoon, edited by editorial cartoonist Joe Heller of Green Bay, a man bundled up with his hat and his puffy vest, although he is inside his house. It looks like he's FaceTiming with someone on his computer. The person on the computer is also wearing a hat, scarf, coat, and mitten. And the man remarks to his wife, who is standing across from him, "It's your sister down south calling to complain that it's only 50 degrees there." The first letter is from Emma Schmidt of Rockwell City. Dollars for pipelines could be better spent. In her recent article, How Far Would Iowa Pipeline Projects Go Toward U.S. Climate Change Goals, January 19th, reporter Aaron Jordan asks an important question. Should other industries, besides ethanol, be first to benefit from tax policy? The answer is a resounding yes. Federal policies are sending billions of public taxpayer dollars to false solutions. Money earmarked for clean technologies is being wasted on unsound and unsafe industries, from ethanol to carbon capture. These scams are distractions from the real work of reforming our agriculture and energy sectors to mitigate the impending climate crisis. 57% of Iowa's corn crop goes to ethanol production, feeding dirty car engines, not people. The industry and its 42 polluting facilities across the state cut independent producers out of business and destroy the land through harmful monocropping practices and intensive fertilizer application. Now, carbon capture companies want to do the same thing all over again, jeopardizing our state and our land for their profit. Carbon capture is not clean energy. It's a way to entrench polluting industry and keep them solvent, all while diverting taxpayer dollars away from real solutions like wind and solar. Governor Kim Reynolds must listen to the thousands of Iowans opposed to these pipelines and stop carbon capture in Iowa. Emma Schmidt of Rockwell City. The next letter is from Dick Trotter of Cedar Rapids. Stay out of possible war in Ukraine. The current Washington saber-rattling regarding Ukraine and Russia is terribly risky, if not insane. I am not encouraged by recent statements of some of our political and military leaders. Who would want to be involved in this impending struggle to nowhere? Is the United States prepared to take the lead without the support of NATO, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization? I am old enough to remember the horrors of World War II, Korea, Vietnam, and the Middle East. If you are not familiar with our historical conflicts abroad, educate yourself. This country does not want or need another war. Tell your representatives and senators to butt out of this possible disaster. Dick Trotter of Cedar Rapids. The next letter is from Lena Gilbert of Springville. Reader appreciates that the print goes on. Thank you to the Cedar Rapids Gazette for continuing to churn out a daily paper. In these days of continued emphasis on going paperless, I am so grateful that we still have a daily print edition of the Cedar Rapids Gazette. Stories large and small, bitter or sweet, are so much more affirmative when committed to ink and paper. I am known to grumble just a bit when my paper is delivered late or missed, and it's because I crave that tactile sense with daily news. Thank you to all the Gazette writers, editors, delivery people, press operators, and subscribers for making this a viable daily in-print newspaper. Lena Gilbert of Springville. The next letter, from Ed Wasserman of Iowa City. Grassley has lost courage of convictions. 16 current Republican senators have previously voted for reauthorization of the Voting Rights Act, but they now refuse to support the John Lewis Voting Rights Advancement Act. Guess who no longer has the courage of his convictions? Iowa's own Senator Chuck Grassley. In 2006, Grassley voted for the 2006 VRA reauthorization. Indeed, in 1982, Grassley both voted for and co-sponsored the VRA reauthorization. What's happened since 2006? Quite simply, the highly touted independent voice of middle-of-the-road Iowans has evolved into a dutiful partisan of the GOP political machine, bowing to Mitch McConnell's and Donald Trump's every demand. This November, our state needs a new senator who will actually serve the interests of all Iowans, not the Washington elite. Ed Wasserman of Iowa City. The final letter from Rex Clemenson of Iowa City. Republicans believe only in wielding power. I have been trying to figure out what the Republican Party believes. When Donald Trump was president, he asserted that he had absolute power and Republicans went along. When Biden ordered vaccine mandates for large businesses, Republicans said the federal government could not tell businesses what they can or can't do. Then Iowa's Republicans said that businesses could not have a vaccine mandate. Isn't that telling businesses what they can or can't do? Apparently, Republicans no longer believed in the authority of the federal government, but rather in the power of state officials. But when the state's election officials concluded that Biden won the election, Republicans in the federal government wanted to throw out those states' conclusions. Republicans claimed to believe in local control, but when cities like Iowa City wanted to have local control over mask policy in schools, Iowa Republicans said that only the governor and the state legislature have that power. But when Republican parents want control over what is taught in schools, Republicans again believe in local control. There are even Republican constitutional sheriffs who believe that local sheriffs have the final say on which laws to enforce. They think they are monarchs in their town. It all seems baffling and inconsistent until you look at the common thread. What Republicans believe is that whatever part of government they control, that is the part that has power. If Democrats control a part, that part does not have power. It's perfectly consistent and perfectly hypocritical. Rex Clemenson of Iowa City. You are listening to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Sunday, January 30th, 2022, on the Iowa Radio Reading and Information Service. I'm your reader, Sharon Feldudo, and we turn to today's obituaries. Norma G. Gross, age 87, of Cedar Rapids, passed away on Monday, January 24th. Norma had a radiant smile. Norma and Bob loved to dance and travel together on their motorcycle, an adventure that took them to some great places. A visitation celebrating the lives of Norma and Bob will be held from noon to 3 p.m. Wednesday, February 2nd, at the Cedar Memorial Park Funeral Home. A private family graveside committal and interment will follow at the Cedar Memorial Park Cemetery. Floyd W. Endicott, age 85, of Central City, died Saturday, January 22nd, at the Anamosa Care Center following a short illness. Per his wishes, Floyd donated his body to the UIHC Deeded Body Program in Iowa City. Private family interment will be at a later date. His family is planning a celebration of life service in April. Immediately after high school, Floyd went to work at Rockwell Collins as a machinist and worked his way up to position as buyer. He was employed by Rockwell for 39 years. In his free time, he enjoyed fishing, digging dirt, welding, woodworking, and his dog Zoe. He loved Jesus and believed that when his time on earth was finished, he would spend eternity with him. Richard Moore Pittner, known as Dick, of Cedar Rapids, age 81, passed away on Wednesday, January 26. A celebration of his life will be scheduled later this year. Dick was known for his sincerity, curiosity, and irreverent humor. He was passionate about sharing his enthusiasm for U.S. history, sociology, and Model United Nations with students at Kennedy. Dick had a special interest in military history, particularly naval history, and pursued this avocation through extensive reading and visits to museums, battlefields, and other historic sites. Margaret Maxey, age 101, of Coralville, died peacefully at her home on Wednesday, January 12th, with members of her home safe family at her side holding her hand. Mass of Christian burial will be at 11 a.m. Friday, February 4th, at St. Thomas More Catholic Church, with Father Chuck Adam officiating. Visitation will be from 10 to 11 a.m. prior to the service. Burial will follow at St. Joseph Cemetery in Iowa City. We respectfully request everyone attending services wear a mask. Margaret worked for almost 30 years as an administrative assistant for the University of Iowa Athletic Department, retiring in 1985. She enjoyed traveling with George, including their annual trip to Ocala, Florida, cheering on Hawkeyes football and basketball, and enjoying time with her family and friends. She was a member of St. Thomas More Catholic Church and active on the Coralville Heights Women's Club. James Michael Akers, age 47, of Independence, passed away on Tuesday, January 25th, at Buchanan County Health Center in Independence. A memorial service will be held at 10:30 a.m. Saturday, February 5th, at Murdoch Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Central City, with visitation 1 hour prior to the service at the funeral home. James was a 1995 graduate of Prairie High School in Cedar Rapids. He worked in a grocery store and for Goodwill in Cedar Rapids, and he will be greatly missed by all and who knew and love him. It takes a village to raise a child, and that is especially true of special needs children. James' family would like to extend special thanks to schools, churches, Discovery Living in Cedar Rapids, Penn Center in Delhi, and B&D Housing in Independence. John O'Brien, known as Lee of Monticello, age 52, died Wednesday, January 26, at his home. Funeral services will be held at 1 p.m. Tuesday, February 1st, at Getch Funeral Home in Monticello, where friends may call after 11 a.m. Pastor David Ramage will officiate the service. Masks are suggested, but not required. Lee attended the Anamosa Community Schools. He worked as a mechanic and later at 7th Street Stone in Monticello. He enjoyed NASCAR, camping, rider motorcycles, and snowmobiling. Carol O. Blake, age 62, of Biloxi, Mississippi, passed away unexpectedly on Thursday, January 27th at Mercy Medical Center in Cedar Rapids. A memorial service for Carl will be held at 1 p.m. Sunday, February 6th at Murdoch Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Marion, where family will greet friends and family 1 hour prior. Carl worked as a cable splicer for telecommunications for over 40 years, most recently for telecom construction. He enjoyed spending time with his family and friends, fishing, and riding his motorcycle. Helen Novotny, age 93, of Walker, passed away Monday, January 24th, at Living Center West in Cedar Rapids. Visitation will be held from 4 to 7 p.m. Thursday, February 24th, at United Methodist Church in Walker. A funeral service will be held at 10:30 a.m. Friday, February 25th, at the church, with an additional visitation an hour prior to service. Murdoch Funeral Home and Cremation Service of Marion is assisting the family. Carol Jean Walden, age 84, entered the gates of heaven January 24th after a brief illness. Services will be set for a later date to be determined. Arrangements by Stuart Baxter Funeral and Memorial Services of Mount Vernon. Jean Honeycutt, born Jean Adams of Palm Beach Gardens, Florida, formerly of Avon, Connecticut and Cedar Rapids, Iowa, peacefully passed away in Palm Beach Gardens on January 10th of natural causes. She was born on February 12th, 1933. Jean enjoyed a wide variety of interests, particularly all things home, and thought of herself as a wannabe interior decorator. Finding creative pleasure in making my homes welcoming, comfortable, and attractive. She loved cooking and baking. Her famous hot fudge sauce was a highly sought-after commodity, as well as her coffee cakes and Danish puffs. She loved entertaining and is likely already planning a dinner party in heaven, and it was important to her that she taught her daughters to be proper co-hostesses for all the memorable parties with friends over the years. Due to COVID-19 restrictions, a private memorial service will be held at a later date in Cedar Rapids, where Jean will be laid to rest. Viola Jean Kerr of Rochester, Minnesota, died at home on January 25th. She was born April 17th, 1935. Viola was a typical Iowa farm girl, educated in rural one-room Red School and then Coggin High School, where she learned and loved basketball, especially blocking opponents' shots with her long arms. She graduated from Mercy School of Nursing and worked there for several years. The funeral service for Viola will be at 11 a.m. Monday, January 31st, in the River Park Chapel at Mackin Funeral Home. Alan Donald Nading of Cedar Rapids passed away January 11th at his home in Cedar Rapids. He was born November 26th, 1946. A man who loved working with his hands, he could build anything. Guns and tools were his favorite creations. One of his most memorable and most loved projects was a full-size boat that he built in his living room. He was a hard-working man who could help anyone in any way he could. And Wayne Strobola, age 86, of Gilbert, Arizona, passed away in Gilbert on January 17th. He was born on March 16th, 1935. He served in the Navy during the end of the Korean conflict. Wayne was an incredibly hard worker for his entire life, who began his post-Navy employment at the telephone company as a lineman before spending the bulk of his 30-plus year career as a test technician at Collins Radio in Cedar Rapids. Wayne also raised feeder pigs for many years on their small farm in the rural Coggin area, while being an active member of St. Joseph's Catholic Church in Prairieburg for 53 years and St. Anne's in Gilbert for the past 2 years. Wayne loved a good game of cribbage or dominoes, word puzzles, reading his daily newspapers, and any amount of driving around the country to see many local or national sites. Due to health and safety concerns, a small private family service was held in Gilbert, Arizona on January 22nd. Based on future health and safety situations, a celebration of life for Wayne is being planned in Iowa for close friends and family sometime in late February or March. Turning to the sports page in Iowa State men's basketball, Cyclones play their game, defeat Mizzou. ISU scores 23 points off 18 turnovers in victory by Matt Bellinson, correspondent in Ames. Every team has an identity. Iowa State head coach T.J. Otzelberger has lived that message throughout the season, demanding defensive nastiness, in-your-face pressure, and grit from the Cyclones. There was no identity crisis for number 23 Iowa State in the Big 12 SEC Challenge against Missouri on Saturday, as the Cyclones defeated the Tigers 67-50, and Missouri did itself no favors during the course of the game. Missouri played right into Iowa State's hand from the start, turning the ball over 13 times in the first half, giving Iowa State its winning formula to the tune of 17 points off turnovers before halftime. We really talk about making effort-based plays where we're diving for loose balls. We're getting on the floor, Otzelberger said post-game. The game rewards you when you do that. The Tigers finished with 18 turnovers for the game, allowing the Cyclones to score 23 points off turnovers. Missouri had 13 turnovers total versus number one Auburn on Tuesday. Despite shooting 34% from the field in the first half, Iowa State led Missouri 32-29 at the break. But when your habits are better than your opponents, Otzelberger said, the wins come easier. I'll always be a believer in that you play to the level of your habits, Otzelberger said. A new public addition to the Cyclones' unapologetic identity has been kills. Iowa State views a kill as three straight defensive stops, and the Hilton Coliseum students section took notice. Students acted as unofficial stats keepers Saturday, chanting when a kill was about to be secured. After a successful third stop, a giant X is held up, signifying the win. Every team has an identity. Our identity is stringing together and stacking up defensive stops. Or in the Cyclones' words, racking up the kills. The unofficial tally for kills on Saturday was 9. But does Otzelberger have a target for the Cyclones to meet when it comes to defensive stops? How about 9? Yeah, more than that, Otzelberger said with a smile. Missouri's 50 points is good for the fewest points scored by the Tigers in their rivalry's history since March 2, 2005, 49 points. Tyrese Hunter finished with 0 turnovers for the game. The first collegiate game of his career with 0 giveaways. The freshman put up 14 points, 4 assists, and 2 steals in the 17-point win. But Hunter's most recent spotlight has come from his defense. Hunter was named to the Naismith Men's Defensive Player of the Year watch list on Thursday, making him one of 3 freshmen in the country to make the list. Hunter added to his Big 12 lead in steals with 2 on Saturday and said postgame the Cyclones have to continue their identity going forward. Starting on defense, coming out and pressuring, we stick to our principles and do what we do on a daily basis, Hunter said. The Cyclones' 23 points off turnovers on Saturday was good for the 4th most Missouri has allowed all season. While the first half set the tone for the Cyclones' game plan, the second half is when it all came together. The Tigers' first possession of the second half was an offensive foul on a moving screen, at another turnover. It was over shortly after. The Cyclones erupted on a 17-1 run to take a 51-35 lead with 11:07 left. Missouri went cold for over 7 minutes and a half, including 1 for 10 from the field, with just over 8 minutes gone by. And turning back to the Iowa Today, Riverside Theater welcomes audiences to a new Iowa City home. Professional Troupe prepares to debut in Ped Mall space by Diana Nolan of the Gazette in Iowa City. An empty building on the downtown Ped Mall, home most recently to Trespassers and their graffiti, is nearing the finish line on a dramatic transformation. This Friday, the 3-story space at 119 East College Street, in what's known as the Crescent Block, will open as the new home of Riverside Theater. Audiences will step through the former door of the soap opera and into a long hallway with exposed brick and woodwork that harkens to the building's 19th century beginnings. At the front are the box office and a stairway, but the ground floor hallway also continues toward the back of the building, with benches and an elevator midway to take audience members to the 3rd floor. There, they will step into a gathering space triple the size of the former North Gilbert Street home, and large enough to accommodate cabaret performances, opera on tap, and pre- and post-show salons. The new lobby opens to a state-of-the-art 150-seat theater, up from 118 capacity at the former site. Designed for versatility, seating, and the playing space can be configured in any way imaginable to bring the audience close to the action, thus preserving and enhancing the intimate feel that's been a hallmark of Riverside Theater throughout its 40-year history. Patrons who choose to take the stairs will pass through the 2nd floor, but won't have access to the area containing cast and crew amenities, from a conference room and dressing rooms to a green room with a kitchenette and stacked washer and dryer, as well as a spiral staircase for quick trips to the backstage area 1 floor up. However, the elevator also makes all floor accessible for cast, crew, and audience members with mobility issues, something Riverside's former home couldn't offer. Everything inside the Crescent building is clean and bright, with a modern industrial feel that doesn't cover up the past, including the faded painting of an advertisement for Ayers Pills for the Liver on the far side of the theater, or flaws like chipped or missing bricks and wood patches in the upstairs lobby's wood floor. We're not hiding the changes that we've made. We're not pretending that all this is original, so you can kind of clearly see the history and the new, said Adam Knight, 42, of Iowa City, Riverside's producing artistic director since 2018. This is a building that's 140 years old, he said. I think it was first opened in the 1880s, so these bricks are really old. On a January 19th Gazette walkthrough, he also pointed out such fascinating features as a curved design in the bricks uncovered during the renovation process. We wanted to preserve as much as possible and better tell the story of a place that was forgotten that now has life again, he said. That new life will launch with the world premiere of Eden Prairie 1971 by Matt Smart of Brooklyn, New York, one of Knight's longtime friends and collaborators, dating to their college days and subsequent work in New York's theater scene. And following a time-honored New York theater tradition, the show is opening after five preview performances to give the playwright, actors, and technicians the chance to let the new play breathe and find its legs with an audience. Another discovery seems almost prophetic. Our first preview here is 40 years to the day of our first ever performance. January 27, 1982, was the first performance of The Lesson, directed by Bruce Wheaton, featuring Ron Clark and Jody Hovland, and it was at the Old Armory. As soon as I found that out, it felt very meaningful, Knight said. Just what that moment must have been, to open this theater and have your first audience, and how terrifying and exciting it was. We're in a similar boat now. We're going through all these hoops to get this building ready, and then when those lights go down, it's out of our hands. Telling a story again in the dark. That's very exciting. It's been the glimmer of hope running parallel to a pandemic that in June 2020 shut the doors on the professional theater troupe's former home at 213 North Gilbert Street. The wheels started turning even before the pandemic pauses hit home as the Tailwind Group, a real estate acquisition, development, and management organization based in Mankato, Minnesota, began reimagining three 19th-century buildings along East College Street as part of its $54.4 million revitalization project. Since 2017, Tailwind Group has purchased all the buildings from 109 to 127 East College Street for historic preservation and renovation. Newman Munson Architects in Iowa City has been working with Tailwind on the redevelopment project, and when founder Kevin Munson found out in spring 2020 that Riverside was considering leaving Gilbert Street, even before the pandemic closed the doors, he approached Knight about the East College Street site. That led to a series of discussions, initial plans, and the feasibility of embarking on the theater's first capital campaign in 20 years. With Newman Munson's long history of working with Riverside Theater, including designing the outdoor festival stage in Lower City Park, Munson was especially pleased to see Riverside take a leap of faith into the Crescent Block building. "We've had a special place for Riverside Theater," said Munson, 70, of rural Iowa City. "It's a great gem that we have in Iowa City, to have a professional theater company here in our community. It's so important to our culture and our community to have such a talented group of people working in it and giving jobs to our great acting force. It's super. We've always had in our mind, how do we help Riverside Theater get into a better location with more flexibility? So as we were working with Tailwind Group and putting together a series of studies, Riverside Theater quickly came to mind. Its move also is in line with current theatrical trends. Looking at other entertainment venues around the country, this kind of a little more gritty sort of space that can be flexible and customized for each production certainly was very exciting to us," said Munson, citing project architect Parker Dauberstein and Jillian Riggin, who led the interior design efforts, as doing the heavy lifting with the Riverside project. Knight also was thrilled with the collaborative spirit of the project. "We had the luxury of being involved in every step of this process, and especially in the last month starting to work in here. We're just learning what the space wants, and that's always a little different from how we thought it was going to work," he said. "So this month has been instrumental in getting the space right, and we're still going to be learning over the next few months and still making adjustments." Knight credits Munson with leading the way. "Who walks into a space like this, which was covered in graffiti, which was just kind of an abandoned third floor in a sort of a building, and says, 'I think this could be a theater'?" His vision really drove the whole process from that first phone call that I had with him where he pitched the idea to me, Knight said. "And then I brought the conversation to our executive committee, and then that circle kept widening and widening until by the fall of 2020 we were ready to move forward." Munson, however, turns the spotlight onto the Tailwind Group. "This wouldn't be possible without the vision of the Tailwind Group and their leadership in making this happen," he said, adding that the economic driver is The Nest, an 11-story apartment building under construction behind the historic storefronts, creating the capital needed for restoration projects. Tailwind also contributed $900,000 toward the Riverside project, easing the theater's fundraising burden for its $1.82 million capital campaign. Knight expects that mark to be reached by Friday's opening night performance. Munson further cited Tailwind's efforts to work with the city to save all of those storefronts on College Street and put them into landmark status so they can never be torn down, so they're preserved for the history and fulfillment of Iowa City. The various phases involved working with the city's historic preservation and zoning groups, as well as the city council. Preliminary support from the council's Economic Development Committee came in early December 2020, followed by a unanimous green light from the city council in January 2021. All along the way, everyone recognized the beautiful opportunity it would be for everyone to give Riverside Theater down in the heart of our community to really reinforce Iowa City being the greatest little city for the arts, Monson said. It couldn't get any better, with film seen across the street and down the block, with our restaurants, with our public library, and with the Englert Theater, Monson noted. I think it just adds life to our community and something that most communities could not pull off. But here we are. We're going to do it. And if you'd like to see the play, that's at 119 East College Street. The play is Eden Prairie, 1971. Friday's an invited audience. Then it opens to the public on next Saturday through February 20th. And you can get tickets at riversidetheater.org/EdenPrairie-1971. And theater, in this case, is spelled with an R-E. And that brings us to the end of reading the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Sunday, January 30th, 2022. Remember that you can access a recording of this or any of our other IRIS recordings at any time on our website, iowaradioreading.org. I'm your reader, Sharon Falduto. Thank you for listening.